Welcome back to Making Conversation, a show that features conversations with artists and designers about the journey from bright-eyed newbie to fame monster. My name is Justin Ulm, and this is my co-host,
Sean the Scapegoat.
And we are here with
Peter Cockney.
The conventional cheer at the start of every show. So, thanks for joining us today, Peter.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, so we're here at Greystone Books.
It is, yes.
I don't know if we're supposed to be saying that on the show.
No, it's fine. It's fine. They,
beautiful to you.
They're okay with us.
Yes, they're okay. They know we're here.
Okay. Thanks for coming on the show. I wanted to take like a little bit of time at the start here just to read a bio of you.
Oh.
Yeah. And we'll see if you
The question is that this is a... There are real bios of me floating around, but there are some, they're more buried on the internet. But when I was younger, I had a propensity for kind of making a few things up. It was one that floated around for a while that said I was in the Maple Leafs farm system for a few years.
Oh.
People used to believe that, right?
Really? But
yeah, I never was, of course. And another one that in my spare time that I draw the comic strip Pud that appears in Double Bubble. As my father and grandfather did before me, which is not true, but I've had people come up to me and say, "So you draw Pud?"
Man, I don't know if I should read this bio now. I feel like you're already saying things more interesting than what I've got on paper here.
I think all the it's probably boring and honest. Yeah. I'm older now, so.
But yeah, we'll just see if you can recognize where this is taken from.
All right.
I don't know. It's kind of a fun little game to kick off the show. So Peter Cockney is a Vancouver-based designer and design teacher specializing in typographic.
From Emily Carr.
Oh man, that was so fast.
Okay. I wrote it.
Yeah, right? I know. I was wondering how those things went down, you know, if like it's such a boring task for teachers to do that.
And you have this like little word limit, so you're always taking you're taking adjectives out to make it fit.
Wow. Yeah. I wonder if it's the same text field or whatever that or text box that students get.
Probably.
Like,
okay. Anyways, not to keep interrupting.
You are currently the creative director of Peterco Design. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Cool. Previously, he was a founding partner of Figure One Publishing, and from 2002 to 2012, was an art director of D&M Publishers, the publishers of Douglas and McIntyre and Greystone Books. His practice has been wide from books to annual reports, snack food boxes to CD packages, corporate identity programs, newspapers, magazines, and websites. Peter has received more than 50 awards for his work and has lectured throughout Canada and the U.S., including at the national conferences of the AIGA and
It's the American Association of University Presses.
Okay.
AAUP.
Cool. And also to the Type Directors Club in New York. In 2009, Peter was the first Canadian juror at the International Best Books in the World competition. And in 2013, he received the Ian Wallace Award for Teaching Excellence at Emily Carr. Peter also teaches at Simon Fraser University. So that was like the most formal introduction we've ever given anyone on this show. So, Oh yeah, I also like to say that Nayeli is here, our facilitator.
There you go.
Over keg beers at the WTCU opening party, Nayeli said we should talk to you. So that's how this all
came. Thank you, Nayeli.
Thank you, Nayeli. Working late, working hard. Not just working late, slacking.
No.
Oh yeah. Well, first of all, we are very, very stoked to have you on our show. Yeah. And during our research, when we were creeping on your name on Google, we found out that you had to shut down some other people, such as the casual optimist, as known as Dan Wagstaff,
right,
of Raincoat Books. So this makes us feel really special.
Because I haven't, it's funny that the thing for Dan. I've known Dan for a few years now, and it's like half written. Like he asked me a couple years ago to write because his is all about writing, so you can't, it takes a lot more time, right?
Yeah.
And so I, and he had these questions that kind of went back in time. So, you know, I sat down and did part of it once, and it was several thousand words.
Wow.
So I thought, okay, I'm not going to have a chance to, I don't have time to finish this. And every time I go back to it, I find one of the questions is no longer applicable. Like, I'm not doing that anymore.
Right.
So I keep telling him, I don't know, I told him I would have something a few months ago. I said, June? I'll have something in June.
Yeah.
So I don't know, maybe I will. I haven't gone back to
probably him. Next year, June.
Maybe I'll just tell him, I sent him the half I'd written like earlier this year. Maybe I'll just say, you know, just run that and leave the gaps.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, hopefully, we're not expecting any long-winded answers from you on anything here.
But, I can be long-winded, so I'll try not to be.
Yeah. So we're always curious about like how our guests become who they are,
right.
I guess. And starting off, like, you know, way back, I guess, maybe for some people, less for others. We're curious to know, like, if you were a creative as a kid.
I was. You know, it's funny, the... when I was like elementary school age, the main thing that was really writing. I used to write stories all the time. What kind of got me, I think, kind of on this path was comic books. You know, like when I was like elementary school age, early high school age, I was into comic books and got interested in just trying to draw like that, right? So, you know, I ended up like spending an inordinate amount of kind of high school years, like when I was watching television, I would, you know, draw, right? And ended up like publishing a couple of like, you know, fan comic books when I was like 13, 14, that kind of thing. And you know, when I got a little bit older, I started, first I thought, oh, I want to do this when I like grow up, like I want to draw comic books. And I don't know, I got like less, it seemed maybe a little too nerdy to me when I got older, and I discovered this thing called graphic design, like in high school. So we had I grew up in Ladner, which is, for those of you in Vancouver, it's like on the way to the ferry, right?
And
it's just a suburb now, but it was kind of this kind of half suburb, half like farming fishing town then, right? You know, that a lot of like, you know, working kids, like, my grade 8 class had 300 some odd, and my grade 12 class had 150 some odd.
Yeah.
Huge dropout rate. And of that, I think maybe 110 graduated. So maybe a third of the people who were there in grade 8, just over that, actually graduated in grade 12. So there was lots of, you know, the kind of school where you could take 6 units of shop and then a study.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of that stuff. So we had this whole graphic arts program because I guess they were preparing kids for the trade. Mm-hmm. But it was great when I discovered that, because we had a printing press, we had an old CompuGraphic typesetting machine, right? Mm-hmm. We had the whole, this is going to be Greek to a lot of people, but photomechanical transfer cameras. These were things that we used to use before computers to make, to reduce and enlarge images. They filled rooms, right?
Yeah, back in the days.
Yeah, we had silk screening stuff. So that's really where I kind of thought, oh, I can take this sort of interest in drawing comic mm-hmm. books, and there's something real to do with. That's really where I got interested in doing this kind of thing, you know, for a living.
After high school, like, did you have any kind of formal education in design before you started working professionally, or?
I have a BA in English.
Oh, nice.
So yeah. It's funny. I actually got a scholarship, piddly little thing from Emily Carr. When it was in grade 12. There was some, I don't really remember exactly the details, but there was some show, you know, you could enter. And so, the funny thing is that what I entered, I thought I would do like crappy because everybody else, it was some, I can't remember where it was in the city, but there were students from all over and everyone's stuff is so like slick, like they had paintings and mine was all process, and it was all like, I don't know, it was paste ups, it was all rough, and it was more kind of graphic stuff like that. And even the drawings were all like, again, kind of a more of a rougher scale. And of course the irony was that that's actually what they wanted to see. It was like process, not
right.
sort of this finished perfection. But I didn't use it because I, you know, at that point I was like, what's Emily Carr? You know,
and yeah.
This was then, right? This is, no offense to Emily Carr. This was a long time. This was a long time ago. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I just like, you know, went to UBC and I was playing in bands. It was just like,
yeah.
you know, I can read books and do this in my spare time is what it seemed like. It was kind of a total waste of education,
nice.
Really. But I was always designing stuff for the bands I was in and for friends' bands and stuff. So that's, you know, I kept doing this stuff. But I didn't, I have no formal education in it. It was the first job I had was actually through writing, but I ended up doing more design there too. Yeah.
How did you segue from the writing into the design in job?
The job I had was a place that I don't even know if it exists. It was this company called Offshore Systems on the North Shore. And they made these, they might still, made these big like computer navigation systems for ferries and things like that.
Right. Yeah.
So they would be these multi-million dollar systems and they sell like one, but they needed like manuals for them and the manuals were like huge. So it was like a technical writing job. The woman who hired me was like, I was, you know, 21 and she was maybe 3 years older or something like that. We were really young.
Yeah.
And it became evident though right away they needed some kind of visuals for these things. Like there were all these visual charts and stuff like that. And they need to make them look like you're paying $1 million for a system. Even if you're getting a one-off manual, I have to make it look decent, right?
Totally.
So yeah. I was writing these things and I just volunteered. I just said, oh, I can do this. I can draw these charts. And so we actually bought this is going way back. Like in, this is 1985. So we bought like a first generation Mac.
Oh, wow.
We were one of the first 100
registered users of PageMaker.
We were like one of the first 100 registered users of PageMaker.
Oh, man. So
it was really primitive, but it was still faster than hand drawing and photocopying and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the whole graphic style was all, I was trying to imitate like charts that were made on computers anyway.
Right? Yeah.
So, so I quickly found like this was more interesting. So I started designing for them, like designing like what would the keyboards look like? What would the units they made look like? I would just draw this stuff for them, right? And and that kind of led to, I got a job after that. I didn't say that long. It was 14 months or so. I got a job at them. They used to have what they called service bureaus. Like before printers would take the plunge and buy all the gear and all this Mac stuff. This was happening really fast, right?
Yeah.
These companies would start up and they would be like instant printers slash they would, you'd have like a laser printer was $7,000 then. So most people couldn't afford them. So you'd have a thing where you'd run laser printers and this company I was hired by had a Linotronic, which was a typesetting machine that attached to Macs.
Yeah.
So we did a combination of like really ultra low-end armpit flyer design, right? That's what it's doing. And you help people who came in who were, you know, other young designers doing this. So that was like the next job, sort of falling through that and without going to a lot of, you know, like details, essentially that led me to a real, a couple years later, I ended up with like a real studio job as a junior designer, a place called Kent Allen Design, which was then kind of a big 20 people kind of corporate firm, right?
Yeah.
And so I just started at the bottom really there. Like I'd been doing this completely kind of untrained sort of, you know, design. And really that's where I learned is like a, it's like the old apprenticeship model. Like I learned from the senior designers and you start out doing, because I knew the technology a lot,
right?
It wasn't that hard to learn then. But I started out doing more production and they give you more design. And, you know, by the end of it, I was studio manager after a few years.
Wow, crazy. Because,
yeah, it was a different, it was kind of the cusp of things were changing. There were only, there were like a handful of big firms here, like 20, 25 people. And then a lot of them started to die off and everyone went off into, you know, because you could run a small shop with a Mac into little shops of like, 1, 2, five people, right? More the way it is now, these small shops. Yeah.
Do you miss that like really tactile, physical form of design work?
Sometimes. Like there's a yes and no, you know, like there's definitely stuff about it that was sometimes it, you know, they're just using your hands. It's a great thing. I still like to sketch and stuff like that. But I do remember like a lot of the production stuff, you know, like again in the early days of the Mac, it was there were a lot less things you could do, right? Or you couldn't do them as well. So, you know, like scanning was still like a high-end buyout thing. And even until like the early 90s, there weren't as many typefaces available. So we were still kind of mixing. Like you would sometimes buy some old school type if you couldn't get the typeface you wanted. Mm-hmm. And I don't miss like paste up. Like, or ruling, like having to take a ruling pen and drawing corner marks. So it's really tedious, right? And there's stories I could tell. Like, I mean, I remember early, one of my first sort of real design jobs at Kent Allen when I moved up and I got a whole project for myself, right? Mm-hmm. So I was designer, I was going to produce this and all the rest of it. And it's really ridiculous. It was for a company, I think it was just one guy really, called Hookset. And what he made, it was like a kind of semi-automated ice fishing
thing,
right? Yeah. It was this thing you could set up somehow, and you could leave it and go away and drink somewhere warmer, I guess. And it was supposed to kind of catch fish for you, right? So I remember I had one of these, and this is the first time I had an art director of a photographer. I had to hire a photographer, a guy who did product shots, and set these up and do, you know, like I had to build it, set the thing up for him and do the shots of that and all the detail shots and stuff like that. And, you know, in the days before you could scan, we used to get what they called C prints, color prints, size and to size. So you would work out, like, with a sketch what size they would be, and you'd give them the size and they'd give you the print. And you would run off on the Mac like a grid, basically a page of boxes or wherever the photos are supposed to go. You'd have your type in there and just boxes. And then you would take acetate and put it over top of the type, over top of the boxes, and you rough cut the photos and put them on top on a light table. And then at a printer, they would do the camera work to merge that.
Yeah.
So you had to run all the photos through a waxer. And I don't know if anyone knows that, you know, those younger listeners. A waxer is just like it describes. It's a machine that produced hot wax. You could put anything through it. You know, the side that you weren't using, obviously, would get this coating of wax on it. You could stick it down and it would adhere, right? Nice and neat. Anyways, so this is my first job. And I remember the very first thing, the cover image, big image, right? I've got to put this down. I run it through the waxer upside down.
Oh, whoa. Man.
It comes out, it's coated in wax on the image. And of course, Craig. I'm totally freaking out. This is late. Most people are probably gone. I don't know what this costs, but I'm assuming, like, to get this size, it's like, right. I'm going to be in shit if I can't fix this. So that's the day I discovered the virtues of rubber cement thinner. Right?
Okay.
We had some around, so I thought, I'm going to try. What can I do to save this? Right? So, you know, obviously water's not going to work. It's wax. So I tried a little bit.
Yeah.
Rubber cement thinner took the entire coating of wax on it, and the picture looked as good as new.
Really?
Yep.
Didn't get wrecked.
No, it was fine. I put it back in the right way, and all was well.
And you're like...
Yeah. I had a few adventures like that.
But you didn't have to book a flight to Yukon.
No. There was a time, and this is say back again when the laser printers were, you know, $7,000 or so, where I tried to see...
Goodness.
And again, I was like... Like Nelly here, I was the last one there, and I was trying to see if I could run something on acetate for a presentation.
Yeah.
I thought, let's see if I can put it through the laser printer, right? So I put it through the laser printer, and nothing comes out.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, oh my God, have I like melted like acetate and like, ruined it? Yeah. Right? So I remember I was there for hours. I took the whole thing apart.
Oh man.
With screwdrivers, I piece by piece and labeled everything the order it went in. Because the acetate was at the very bottom.
Oh my!
It was actually just all folded up. It was okay, but you know, I don't know. It was all these pieces, every little piece, and I took the acetate out and I put it all back together.
It's actually really funny that you said you did that because I ran some acetate through a laser printer, actually at Emily Carr of all places. And I will never do that again.
Did it survive or?
It went in.
Okay. And then
I was like, it's not coming out.
So you ran away.
I learned later there is acetate you can buy.
Oh, okay,
that's like sort of photocopy your safe that will go through.
Because it's heat resistant maybe. So
exactly.
So basically the one I went through was not.
Say hi to Emily Carr technicians.
Yeah,
any Emily Carr technicians listening, it's Justin Alm, A-L-M.
You can, I don't know, I'm already gone.
Yeah.
But I was going to say I might get an extra like little bit tacked onto my tuition or something. Maybe if I take a continuing studies course or something.
Yeah. And they probably just, you know, rack it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually a nice segue into the next session. We wanted to talk to you a little bit about teaching. So,
So since you've been in the industry for so long, when did you start teaching then?
I started Emily Carr in 2002. I had done before then, I'd been teaching in the summers at SFU since 97. And actually, even before that, in the early 90s, friend of mine who was from a different part of the industry, more the sales part of it, had a company for a couple of years. It was called Technographics, and his whole thing was he was trying to teach. I guess this was when a lot of people in the printing side of the industry and that whole thing were actually slower to kind of catch up with designers and so on. So his whole thing was to teach. People from that side of the industry, the kind of service side, about the technology. And so I worked with him like on a freelance basis for a couple of years. I would come in and do like seminars. It was mostly to really introductory, like people who would never, a lot of them, like they hardly used a computer, right? Mm-hmm. So it was just like the most basic. A lot of them just, they didn't even know what, you know, like you could do at all. So, mm-hmm. so like at least they could talk the language with their designers and mm-hmm. so on. So I had done that. I'd done that kind of teaching. And then at SFU, you know, say in the summers, we used to run this publication design, like it was kind of like a boot camp course. It was like a week. It was like all day, night kind of thing. You'd do it for 5 days, kind of 9 a.m. till 10 p.m, midnight the last night. And then you presented to a little panel of designers the next day. Mm-hmm. So we used to do that in the summer. And then for years I was involved in, they used to have a summer publishing course, which is really where they took the kind of the core of SFU as a master's in publishing, and they just kind of distilled the essence of that down. And again, a 2 week boot camp. It was like 9 a.m. till midnight for 2 weeks.
Yeah. Jeez Louise.
And that's it. So I did for the we'd go into the last week, and it was really, it was in a way, I do some lecturing, but mostly for that. At the very beginning of both those courses, we actually tried to, I don't know why, I wasn't you know, directing these things, to have the students do design, simple design work, but none of them were there to be designers. They were there to be like in publishing in some way, right? Mm-hmm. And the same with the masters. I've been working with the masters of publishing since 97 too. Mm-hmm. So they're really, eventually we got rid of that idea. There's no point in them really being designers.
Yeah.
It's better for them to learn how to interact with designers. Right. So the model became, like there would be two or three designers there, and we were like their staff. You'd go and they were formed like in publishing groups, and we'd go there and they would tell us about the titles and what they wanted. And then we would design them, but sitting with them, so you could kind of explain your process, your concepts, how it works, right? So I've been doing that for a while. And then Emily Carr, actually, Bonnie, who is now like the dean, right?
Bonnie Zibilotti.
Yeah, Bonnie Zibilotti. She and I had been in the, she had been in this publishing boot camp, or not the publishing one, the general kind of publication one.
Okay.
I was there a little longer, then she came in and we got to know each other. And she actually brought me in to Emily Carr to teach a course there. So you know, that's sort of how that all started.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you obviously have like convictions about design education, considering the number of years you've been instructing at Emily Carr and SFU. Were you inspired to teach when you started, or was it just another avenue to work? Or?
It's funny because, you know, I mean, it's something that I quickly realized that I really love doing it, right? But I think it's just because, you know, I like to talk. and a bit, you know, perform and so on. That you're, it's a little bit of a stage thing. But I didn't especially know, like I knew I, because really a lot of the SFU stuff was a little bit different. I always liked the lectures and stuff like that. And so it was really when I did the first class at Emily Carr, you start to see that there is something that, when you start to see somebody who's, you know, struggling a little bit, right? And you actually see them kind of climb up kind of a level, that's sort of like it's exciting to sort of see that, that happen, right? And, I often found that a lot of people, it's much better now. I think they have a much better core of, teachers than, well, I don't want to say speak ill about anybody, but I think the faculty is really strong now. And maybe it wasn't as shaped the way it should have been back when I started, because you'd see people like in fourth year, and the first couple years I was there, I'm thinking, you don't know anything. Like, you know, I mean, you have no fundamentals. Like, you don't know.
Are you talking about me?
But, you know, people have no understanding of the foundational principles of like composition.
Right. Yeah. Or anything like that, right? I can see that. Yeah.
And so, you know, that sometimes in the early years, it felt with some people like a little remedial, but it was exciting to see how quickly they could. You know, they were like sponges. People want this stuff, right?
For sure.
And I think that's something that sometimes gets lost. Is, you know, the there's a lot of kind of core. I mean, the car's always been really good, sort of idea developing. But there's a lot of kind of core skills. It's like, you know, if you want to build a chair, the very first thing you need to do is learn how to use a hammer and a saw, right? Like you kind of need to master certain skills.
Yeah.
And then you can build a more advanced chair. But you can have the idea for the greatest chair in the world, but if you don't know how to build it,
yeah,
you're kind of stuck. Right? Yeah. So
there's no way to prove your idea to be true.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Do you remember like the experience of the teaching your like first class?
Yeah, I do. I do.
What was it like?
The first class, it was like the first sort of Emily Carr class. I mostly remember that I think partly, you know, I didn't know this at the time, but I think, again, because when I came in there, and this was, more than like a dozen years ago. Mm-hmm. So I think the faculty had tended to be, at that point, they'd been there for a while. So it skewed a little older, and I was younger. Yeah. So without knowing it, I kind of think I was just sort of different from what, other than a few people like Bonnie, from what they were used to, right? So, mm-hmm. And coming in from kind of the real world. And of course, they just kind of, which I'm glad they did, they just kind of let you loose. It's not sort of, right. Here's how we do it, that Bonnie mm-hmm. said, well, he knows how to kind of work with people and let him go. And so I think at first they kind of just didn't know what to make of me, you know?
Like yeah.
You know, you do those kinds of things to kind of get to know sort of yeah. people, which I don't really do much anymore because usually, you know, you either, like a lot of times I'm teaching students I've already had, or the groups are, you know, smaller that, I don't know, I remember doing some of that stuff. And people were just definitely, it was just different, I think. They weren't used to that kind of less formal, you know, and I'm not very formal. And I think they were yeah. used to a more formal kind of a way of approaching it, and more theoretical, so that... So it was a little, you wonder at the end of the first class, like, are they, am I getting through to them? Or are they completely lost? Because
yeah.
you just can't really tell, you know, then. It sort of took a couple of classes before you start to see, okay, the reason they seem kind of lost, because there were a number of them, you know, who just, they said they seem to be lacking a lot of kind of fundamentals. So I actually went back in that first class I had and just said, okay, we're going to do like a couple of lectures and little assignments that are just fundamentals.
Yeah.
So just to kind of let's try and bring everybody up
totally.
To speed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you find like if you look back on your teaching career that the methods you used when you started have changed and they've evolved over time?
Yeah, I think so. I think you get like you start to kind of find out I think students like a lecture because you can sit there passively, and if you try and make it like funny, they enjoy it. But I actually don't think I do less of that than I used to, because I don't think people learn as much.
Right? Oh, really?
Yeah, well, they sit there and just, you know, take it in. Right? So
I think he's talking about me.
Maybe, but you know, the goal is to try and do.
Like, I never had a class with you, so I guess I have no way to like. Right, right.
The goal, I think, is the more you can make people, you know, just. Do the work. Like, I mean, in a way that I always thought the model that I liked is the way they teach creative writing at the master's level, which is essentially a workshop model. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. it's work and response, right? And that, so instead of like going off for a long time and coming back with a finished thing in a process book, it's like, I want to see work every week mm-hmm. and let's work on, you know, like improving that work sort of week to week basis. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's simple. It's not that complicated as a way to do it, but it's also really old school. I mean, it's yeah. not dissimilar from the seminar model that we go back to, like the Greeks, right? The
yeah.
small groups, it's simple. But I think actually, like, you know, small groups, intense feedback, having the students do work mm-hmm. every week. I find that I do more and more of that, even though it is very straightforward, but I think it works the best.
Yeah.
Like people do better work when they have to, you know, show something every week and have to work on it every week.
Totally.
And so on.
Kind of more of a reflection of the real world too, like
yeah, it is.
Instead of you know, yeah. ivory tower design process
yeah,
or something,
exactly.
where like you're not forced to output and like talk about it, and yeah.
And it's nice. Like I've been trying to do some things. I can't remember if I started. Well, yeah, this was the first. There's one thing. Like in fourth year, I started the year you guys at an Alien Gray, and I would have graduated, mm-hmm. Which was doing this sort of type museum project.
And yeah.
That's actually yeah. grown into, we're going to do it. All the type classes will be involved
oh,
next
nice.
Year. Yeah. And it's just a thing I started, but it's kind of taken over. And it was, there's a few things like that. It sometimes was hard to kind of get like official sanction I found before you do it. So we just started to do it like first in the classroom. And then by last year we had the whole concourse gallery.
Yeah.
So it gets bigger. So it's, you know, the assignment is that everybody has to take, they have to kind of create a piece that educates people, mm-hmm. informs them on something to do with typography. So it can be, you know, like very, you know, straightforward, and you, what did you expect? Like, here's something about the history of something. Or it can be kind of left field. Like, I had a guy once do, well, the first year, did, it was all about like hip hop type, right? And it was cool too. So that, you know, that, I try not to let people, have some room for expression, stuff like that. But when you have something like that where you know you have to create a whole presentation that is not just for class, but people are gonna come into it, and each year we get more and more people. That I think really motivates
totally,
you know, students, that kind of thing. So
yeah,
I was actually inspired to do, this is letting cat out of the bag, I haven't decided exactly what I'm going to do, but I went to the kind of a conference a few weeks ago that put on by Cause and Effect, the Fuel kind of thing.
Oh, okay,
right? Which, and there were some interesting things there. And there was a guy from, I can't remember if he's actually from Chicago or Philadelphia because he teaches in both, but he's an industrial designer and he teaches, but he does a lot of things. He actually works more with like disadvantaged youth and so on. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the things they do are, they're more process-based rather than sort of final goal. And he works like right with them, right? Mm-hmm. So they all try and like do something together. And I like that idea of trying to do something where everybody sort of works on something, you know, including me, even like them doing something sort of next year. I'm not sure what it would be.
Yeah.
But to do something where there's a kind of a deliverable, and maybe it's a group deliverable in some way. I know the group is tricky because you have to need to find a way to allow everybody to succeed at their levels and not have like, you know, the people who are more confident take over and either push out the people who are less confident or, you know, vice versa. You got to find a way to do that. But I think there's something interesting in that anyway. I haven't worked out exactly what I want to do, but something new with it anyway.
Cool.
Yeah.
We noticed like you received the Ian Wallace Award for Teaching Excellence in 2013. How did that feel?
That was nice. I mean, it's like, you know, it is, when you do that kind of thing, you know, you're, you, I guess anecdotally, right, you hear from students, and it's nice to hear those things. Like, I had somebody once, just a couple years ago, someone sent me an email. It was more or less out of the blue. Someone who graduated, I don't know, 2005 or 6 or something like that, like quite a while ago. And she was working, maybe still is, I don't know, in like Montenegro, designing for some like resort place, right?
Yeah.
And just said, you know, you were the only teacher I understood. Like everything I learned, I learned from you. And I kept that email because I thought, oh, that's really sweet, right?
Yeah.
So it's nice to obviously hear those things, but you know, you get the little forms that students fill out, but not everybody fills them out.
Yeah.
Everybody gets their comments. So it's just, you know, it's nice to get feedback and know, okay, you're probably doing something right.
I think I remember writing on that evaluation sheet, I think I said, I love you, Peter.
Well, that's nice. Yeah.
Wonder if you still keep it.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice to get, like, you know, a bit of a critique, too, like when it's... because sometimes there is something, you know, someone will say, and you'll think back, and like someone might, you know, they might say, oh, I think we spent too long on something.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, you can read and think back and think whether you agree or disagree. And sometimes you go, yeah, maybe you're right. Like maybe we should change the pacing if I do that assignment again, or change the structure of it a little bit. So it's, I like when there are those places for feedback, you know, because then you know, presumably can get a little better.
During your interview for Nigel Beale's Bibliophile podcast, he talked to you a little bit about teaching.
I've never listened to that.
I listened to a few things that you've done. Just getting ready for this because I didn't want to like ask you redundant questions and stuff. But I'll paraphrase a little bit of how you described a good student. Taking on complex projects, interested in taking on challenges, has an understanding of typography and narrative within, say, like a book or throughout an entire project. Competent with managerial tasks, has an ability to navigate complex problems, taking design way beyond the cover, I guess.
Oh, that's, yeah, I guess we were talking specifically about books,
yeah,
probably,
because it was design, a book. Probably the publishing, maybe. Yeah. I don't know, maybe something else. There's always something new, and a student doesn't shy away from learning new things. They have to be bookish, into the medium, with an understanding of what makes a book tick. The most important thing is to make text clear and readable, like Beatrice Ward's Crystal Goblet right. concept. Yeah, so with all of those things listed, how often do you see this type of student crop up in a class?
Well, we could extrapolate from that a little bit, because obviously that was, because Nigel's thing is all about books, so I'm yeah. probably talking specifically about books. But you can take, I think, a lot of those kinds of concepts and apply them to like almost anything, right? And mm-hmm. one of the things that can really make a difference is it's like understanding the object, right? That you, in that you're trying to deliver. In that most of the time, like designing something is like it's like giving someone a gift, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to have something of yourself in there. But more than anything, you want to please the recipient, right? So mm-hmm. that, you know, you are concerned not just with sort of like what you want, but what you think the recipient wants. And usually, in any kind of object, most of the time there is sort of a form with some expectations, right? Mm-hmm. So like, you know, people expect certain things, like, you know, we expect a book to work a certain way. And there are times where it's totally appropriate to break those expectations, but often, you know, it just kind of pisses people off, right? Mm-hmm. And same, like, you know, a website that should work a certain way. There are things we can do that are new, we can bring in new things, but if you just totally don't follow conventions, unless it's deliberately very arty, again, people just get frustrated. So you have to kind of deliver what they need.
Yeah.
And that to me is one of the first sort of signs that it's not going to work if whoever's designing something, if they don't really understand the object. Like if you haven't figured out mm-hmm. sort of like what are you actually designing? What yeah. does the audience expect from it?
Right.
And, yeah. you know, so what do you need to do to fulfill those expectations, right? Even if you're going to subvert them, you have to understand them. If you don't understand yeah. them, you know, you can just tell you're going to fumble all the way through,
yeah.
right? If you haven't figured it out. So that's a big thing, I think, is that like that sort of figuring out and understanding it. I also think like when I said sort of bookish, I think you could extrapolate in that I think literacy just generally helps, right? And it's you know, it's still surprising sometimes I when you do find like designers who don't really read, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying you don't have to read literature.
Definitely talking about me.
but it helps to read just generally. I have like some knowledge sure. of like, right. you know, the culture you're operating
yeah
and you know where it comes from and something like that, because that's like a treasure trove for a start, like you know, I mean, so many signifiers that we use that are kind of visual shorthand are based on what the culture knows,
yeah,
and the more you understand that, the more you have access to these kind of symbols and mm-hmm. little thing devices you can use that are kind of just redolent with meaning, right? And so mm-hmm. having a bit of a kind of a cultural literacy, I guess, really, really helps, right?
Mm-hmm.
And understanding of narrative, I think, really helps too, because we tend to, just as people, we're drawn to stories, right? And we make everything into a story. We tend to mm-hmm. automatically structure our lives in a narrative way. So the more you understand just how narrative works, even if you're not mm-hmm. like a, you know, big kind of reader of fiction, but the more you understand how narrative works, design is almost always telling a story. You're almost yeah. always trying to kind of bring, you have a point of entry, you have a point of exit, you've got a beginning, middle, and end, even if it's just a flat two-dimensional piece mm-hmm. or something. So you want to narrate that. You want to kind of figure out, you know, the how you bring someone in, how you take them out, and how you tell them what you want to tell them. So mm-hmm. those kind of things, I think, apply broadly to anything. You were asking like how many people I see like that.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, it's growing. I think that yeah. I would say that, again, over the years I've been at Emily Carr, that probably as the school's reputation grows, I think the yeah. level, you know, it does vary. I mean, obviously that, you know, you get a year where it seems the quality's really high. Maybe the next year there's still some really good people in it, but you know, things vary yeah. for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it has been kind of increasing. And so, yeah, you get more people you know, who are kind of at a higher level. I think one thing that actually helps is, funnily enough, is that it often helps to take another degree before design.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people, didn't you?
Yeah, I took a history degree.
Yeah. So a lot of people who come in, they have all that shorthand, like they know how school works.
Yeah. Right?
So when you see, you know, like a lot of people who have come right out of high school, especially in the earlier years, sometimes they're still getting their feet wet in like how a university works, right? When they know all that, some of the courses, like the more academic ones, you know, they just whip them off. They're not a big deal.
Totally,
they've done that before. And I think, you know, again, this is doesn't apply across the board, but I've often seen people who have that degree really get a lot out of it because, you know, they're at a stage where they can now take in this extra level on top of what they already know.
For sure. It actually just helps to, like, to be able to structure your thoughts. Like, I mean, for those academic courses, I found it was just a cakewalk of it at Emily Carr. Like, I think they expect a little bit less in terms of like writing and research out of you.
I mean, it is a reality that you have to be like, I don't know how they decide this, but I think it helps obviously anybody in like our fields now. We all communicate. So
with
some level of writing, just so you can even send like a coach an email, is helpful. But people go into design because in some ways they don't want to. They're not writers, they're not mathematicians. You know, they go into design for that reason. So I sometimes wonder like where there's more emphasis, you know, in recent years in Emily Carr on other aspects, academic aspects or research. For some people that's totally the right thing and totally cool.
Yeah.
But for some people it's just inapplicable. It's kind of like if you again, I'll use my creative writing thing. If you take a degree in creative writing, nobody expects you to design the book.
Yeah.
Like they're totally different skills.
Totally. Right?
So it's kind of like if you're designing something in the real world, none of us write the copy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, very rarely, right? That generally it's a totally different thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I almost think it's better in those cases to put together partnerships and have people work with someone who else that's what's going to happen to them. They need to know how to navigate that.
Yeah.
And you'll get better material anyway.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Not everybody's Robert Bringhurst. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Writing the poetry and typesetting it in beautiful books.
There are some people like that, but there aren't that many people who have it's such a wide range of skills, right?
Right. Yeah. Totally.
Oh, this is a nice segue to talk about Peter's design career.
Yeah.
Despite your bio on Emily Carr's website, the internet shows us that you work for like Figure One Publishing, Greystone Books, and Peter Co. and Douglas and McIntyre. Like, who do you really work for?
Well, if I told you that, I'd have to kill you.
I didn't know that was going to be part of the interview.
right now, I'm essentially just me, right? It's just sort of the sole shop. I had that work. For a year, I was part of the Figure One sort of startup, and they're still going, but I left February, I guess, at the beginning of this year. I'm Greystone, where we were interviewing. I am officially the art director. It's, again, it's kind of like a consulting thing. I'm here about 8 hours a week, and Nayeli is sort of doing the bulk of the day-to-day design here. And so I'm kind of just doing a whole slew right now of different kinds of things that I have a... I have a grand plan.
Interesting.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't let it slip yet because I don't know if it theoretically requires some funding and things like that. So I haven't been able to. I've been actually so busy over the last few months that's the curse. I mean, I've been freelance before, and the drawback is it can be hard to future plan if you're doing well, because you just end up just working.
Right? Yeah.
So I've just been just working. So I'm actually kind of hoping I have a bunch of things that are wrapping like at the end of this month.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that the summer, I'm not going to go looking for anything for a couple of months. There's stuff I have, but so that I can actually kind of put my head down and sort of think of, you know, like put a plan together to kind of do something. I would like to do something that moves beyond just the sole practitioner thing, because I've kind of, you know, I've done that before. So that, but beyond that, I don't want to, it seems like bad luck to spill any details.
And it's so much more interesting when you keep things secret. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah. And I found like, I worked in between sort of the studio years and before I worked at D&M, in between, I was, I don't know how many years, half a dozen years at least, that I was sort of ran my own business, right? And there are nice things about it because you've got all that flexibility. But after then working with D&M and eventually I had a staff, it's nice to have a team too. It's nice mm-hmm. to have people who you bounce things off of who are other designers. And so, you know, the drawback when you are on your own is you're bouncing things off your clients, but they're, unless you're working with, you know, for an art director, they're often not designers. Mm-hmm. So you don't have that same feedback level. And right. It's nice to have like a, you know, a team to bounce ideas off of.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. We're really interested in process, I guess, for people that people follow when they're working. And like, do you have like a process that you go through with clients? I mean, I guess it would vary from job to job, right? But like, are there certain things on the path of every project that you find like you just have to hit?
It's hard to say in terms of with clients, because it really does depend on who they are and in terms of kind of approval levels, you know, that some people are so, some people come to you, I think, and they don't know anything about sort of design and they're aware of it. And, mm-hmm. The goal is to, in that case, establish that initial level of trust, and then they tend to kind of leave you alone until you have the material to present, right? Yeah. And I mean, certainly there are advantages to that because you know, you're not sort of second guessed, right?
Yeah.
You can get people on the other end of the spectrum who are just really nervous and they need to see kind of a lot
for sure.
of every phase, everything, and you know, that it's hard to generalize. That can be problematic. It depends on the client. Like sometimes they're just nervous, but they actually have a good sensibility and something like that. But I mean, that's the one thing I'm reminded sort of back doing sort of freelance stuff with that range of clients is that, you know, in the end, whoever's paying the freight is always right. Right. So that you definitely get that situation. Even at Figure One, our model, I'm not sure if they've changed things a bit since I left, but our model was different from trade publishers as we were working with clients, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the end of the day, you may present something that you think is sort of the solution and you try and make the case for it. But if they just want something else, if they're like, you know, I don't like green, right? I mean, that, you know, you can make all the
cases. It's always green, isn't it?
Why green is, why green is the right thing for your brand right now. Yeah. I don't like green. That, so if that happens, you know,
I've been in on those discussions,
green, right? Yeah, absolutely. It is always green. It is always green.
Or everything. There's like a aversion to blue in the tech world.
Oh, yeah,
as there should be.
Yeah, I guess
there's just so many tech companies
that have blue.
Yeah,
exactly.
But
I mean, it's funny that an interesting sort of just a single kind of story. Like usually, my tendency over the years has been to reduce the number of options of anything that I actually show. Like because everybody, every designer who's been around for a while has the story of like making this is one thing. I don't know if you guys heard this at school, but this is kind of thing you were told when you started out. Is like, it used to be, give them three.
Yeah.
I don't know why three.
Totally.
Give them three. And always give them one, like, give them one bad one, right? Like, you know, they need something to dismiss. That's the theory. So like, if you got something they can say, oh, this is just shit, right?
Yeah.
Then they're happy and then they can pick a good one. But no, if you do that, they pick the bad one
every time.
Right?
It's so true.
So, I mean, years ago I learned that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if I don't like it, like, don't show it. Like at the end, if you just cannot get a solution past the client and you have to bring one out you don't like, I may have other variants not shown. But the hope is, and then if they don't pick it, if they just don't like it, you know, then you can bring out, go back to one of the old ones, dust it off and show two more or whatever like that. I'd like to do that when you can. It depends, again, sort of more nervous client. They're going to want to see multiples no matter what. But I had, I'm working with a startup, a company called Nonvella right now.
Yeah.
You know, through Gray.
Yeah, Gray and I, we worked on that.
Yeah. And so because they're they're kind of new to the whole sort of publishing thing. This is mm-hmm. they're doing kind of both ebooks and eventually they'll sort of print on demand. But we've been talking about kind of recasting sort of the, I know you guys started kind of covers, yeah. but trying to come to something that will work essentially that they can build a, like a flexible series on and that will work
yeah.
print, but also like little tiny postage stamp on screen, the way we
totally,
covers
yeah.
now, right? And for
like
them,
the Amazon thumbnail size
yeah, exactly.
cover.
Yeah, 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 exactly. And that's something when you're designing like a book cover now, that's always part of the process. It's like, unless it's like a, you know, a big illustrated book where people aren't really looking at it so much online, like it's an arty thing. But most of the time, you've got to figure out what it's going to look like.
Totally.
You know, a couple inches high.
Yeah.
So, but for them, I ended up showing them, oh God, everything almost from one thing, like 60 some odd options, right? I just gave them, and I said over there, some of these were refined, some were really just sketches, like,
yeah,
you know, like they're not all the type is in there, they're just kind of a direction, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was kind of tricky because initially, because then the ones they liked were initially, I thought, well, don't pick those. Like, they're not finished. Now we had another meeting.
Yeah.
And once we had a conversation, you know, it was clear that, okay, really, again, you're coming back to me and saying we like that direction. So I'll refine it. Right?
Yeah.
But that was sort of the, I knew that was the downside to say, okay, here's just everything.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I'm just kind of, you know, throw it all to you, all
totally.
These variants I've done.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see what you think. And so, but that can be risky. Yeah. Because someone can pick, you know, the one, and mm-hmm. this week, at least we had a conversation and I think it's ended up sort of in a happy place. But the first email afterwards, I thought, oh, but you know, no, those aren't done. Those don't work yet. And once they understood that, I thought it was fine.
Yeah.
So, does your hourly rate goes up depending on how annoying your client's first email is?
You know, one of the clients listening, I'd say, no, I have not. I love all my clients.
I guess we're assuming there's a very loose contract.
You know, usually, okay, I don't even like this now, but the kind of, I think what most people do is if you have, because it's like a relationship, right? If it starts out and after a while it's sort of not going to work, you know, your hope is just both sides to exit gracefully like that. You know, you get to a certain level and, you know, you complete it and then it's like, okay, then maybe, you know, we can go our separate ways
right.
and finish this kind of thing. But,
I
mean, I'm pretty good at sort of, you know, doing this long enough, sort of sussing out now. It's like somebody who you kind of get the thing, I don't think we're going to be a good match. And so it might be like where in that case, it's like, we'll be a good match if the pay is high. So in a way, it's not like waiting for the first email.
Yeah.
It's sort of like right away. It's sort of like, okay, I'm not sure about this. So I'll just quote, you know, not egregiously, but it's like a higher quote. It's like saying, you know, there's stuff you'll do for a lot less because you believe in it, you really believe in the people, and you know that they are a startup or something. They
totally,
have a lot of
funds,
right? Mm-hmm. And then there's something where they also have sort of deeper pockets. And you're really unsure. You think, you know, I don't know about this. I'm not getting a great vibe, but I don't want to say no.
Yeah.
But I only want to do it if it's, you know, if I'm going to make money at it, right?
For sure.
So
mm-hmm.
In a way, those are there to support the labors of love, right? The ideal ones are someone, of course, right in between. The ones that sounds really exciting, and I'm going, I've got something, I don't know, it's not 100% signed, sealed, that looks like it's going to be a really nice sort of substantial thing that's right in the middle, that will be coming up, that will be exciting and challenging and pay a reasonable wage, which is,
mm-hmm.
that's really what you want, of course. Yeah.
So, do you cook for yourself?
Do I cook for myself?
Yeah. If so, do you use your cookbooks to design?
No, I do cook, but like cooking is almost, and I do a fair bit, I guess, of the. My daughter is like a vegetarian.
Oh, okay.
And has always been a vegetarian, and is you know, fussy, and I don't know. Everyone seems so busy, so cooking often is okay, and I'm usually because I. About half the time I'm at home, so I'm often the first one there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay, what can I make that either will please everybody or that I can make, you know, two entrees at the same time that are like, you know, one's got meat, one doesn't. Because I like meat.
Carnivore.
Yeah, exactly.
Your daughter's probably not going to listen to this show.
No, but what can I make that, you know, is reasonably nutritious. Everyone will like, can be done quickly enough, and it's not a huge pain to clean. So to be honest, that's my approach to cooking. And even the cookbooks, like I've designed a lot of cookbooks. And I like doing cookbooks. I like chefs. They're fun people to work with because they're often really creative people.
Yeah.
I really like those kind of projects. Yeah, exactly. But my idea of a recipe is I will read the recipe, pull the ingredients, and close the book.
Yeah.
It's just a sketch. It's like, I don't want to have to follow. Like, that's why I'm late. I don't want to be precise. I want to know, okay, this goes in it. I know what those things taste like, and let's just take it from there, right?
Yeah.
And it's got to be short.
Totally,
right?
Like, yeah.
So, you know, a lot of the chefs, I mean, they are, you know, brilliant, creative people, but sometimes you look at the recipes and think, oh, man, this, I'm not going to make this.
No,
it's too complicated, right?
I always love the, like, I mean, the Asian style of cooking, or like Korean, you know, people, they just, it's just like chop up a bunch of stuff, throw it in a pan, saute it, or barbecue it, do whatever you
want. Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like
make it taste good. Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. They got all the right sauces.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like that's the key.
It's like if you go to sometimes like a kind of an Asian restaurant, or like, you know, kind of your basic sort of Chinese Canadian one, and they have that menu that goes on and on and on, right? And it's like hundreds of things.
Yeah.
And you sit down and you think, oh yeah, like they really have this. Like I bet I can go through this and find something that like no one ever ordered. But you go through it and you find no, because really they're all like you say.
Yeah.
A lot of it is just a handful of sauces, handful of ingredients.
Yeah.
You just mix it up differently and you go, no, I bet they can make everything on here like
right
away. Yeah. There's nothing that mysterious. Yeah.
It's like, can I have number 197?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That the miracle
Hold
is more
the scallions.
It's more of a miracle that they know what 197 is
exactly.
than that they can actually make the dish.
Yeah. So I usually never order, like, especially if you order and you've looked at the menu, you've closed the menu, and they come over and you start to give them the name, and they say 197, and you go, I didn't look at the number. Right? You got to go back and go through seven pages to find. Yes, it was actually 196.
So when thinking about the future of book design and ebooks, you said good enough is the great new on Books on the Radio.
Did I say that? I probably should have said, or really what I meant to say is good enough is the new great.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that, and that's not, I think, really that original to me too, in that a lot of people have, kind of posited that change in digital. Like I read something in the New York Times a few years ago where some prof had done this with audio. And was playing to younger people like a really high fidelity audio and then like an MP3 with like cheap headphones.
Right? Yeah.
And overwhelmingly, they chose the cheap stuff.
Oh, really?
That's what they're used to, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we all choose what we're used to, right?
Yeah.
So that, you know, you think of like, I mean, I've had this happen all the time in typography where we try and do, you know, the whole, what we call like the raised pinky typography, like the really, you know, hang your punctuation and all those kinds of things. Make sure everything's optically aligned. And someone comes back, a client or an author, and says, how come the punctuation is sticking out?
Yeah.
Because it's supposed to. Because it did for 400 years. And then suddenly phototype came in the 50s. And so like you have, has anyone seen that thing of Jamie Oliver when he tried to fix the food in British schools.
Oh yes, yeah.
And the kids spat
school
out strawberries,
dinners,
right?
Yeah.
Well, the world's full of people spitting out strawberries like, all the time in all sorts of fields. Like they don't appreciate the nuances. So that, you know, you're trying to give them what they really should have, but their palate isn't there. And so, you know, there's lots of things I love about digital, but there is a fast food factor to everything that's convenient, right? And so there is always the worry, the tendency of like, good enough becomes the new great. It's like that, it just drops the level, right? All the time. I mean, now, you know, if I was going to be devil's advocate to myself, is that we're also probably talking about, I don't know. It's like rose-colored glasses. The era when, you know, great was the real great is probably, I don't know. Did it exist? Maybe it was a small, narrow period when really great was really great. I don't know.
Yeah totally.
When Paul Rand was alive, maybe.
Yeah.
Great was the real great.
I think at this moment, we should take a moment to blame Stephen Harper.
Yeah, that's right. We try and blame Stephen Harper for something on every show.
I think
show.
We can blame him for really anything you want. Yeah,
the
yeah.
decline of publishing and ebooks.
The rise of more suits.
Gray hair.
Yeah, just bad haircuts in general, right?
Like
yeah.
hearing you say good enough is the new great made me think of like a few articles that I'd read, like Craig Maud's, like,
oh yeah, he's an interesting guy.
Post artifact books and publishing article. I don't know. I really like it. But in there he says Roger Bacon held that there were three classes of substance that were capable of magic. Herbal, mineral, and verbal, where with their leaves of fiber, their inks of copperas and soot, and their words, books are amalgamation of the three, which is kind of a really nice, like, poetic way of thinking of books. Do you think ebooks are capable of magic?
You know, probably. I mean, it was funny when sort of the ebook thing first started, I was more cynical about it. It's still annoying how we won't get into reasons why, how ebooks like lag behind the web, you know, like that. I mean, there was that moment a few years ago now when we really started to see really good type on the web, right?
Yeah.
And now you can go to, you know, some sites and especially if you've got like a Retina monitor.
Yeah.
And I mean, I used to think I would never read really on the screen because the type was like whatever, but I read more and more on my iPad now because, you know, the site's got good type. It's, you know, that you can find stuff that really looks, it's the nature of technology. You can't quite get, I think, to the level of a really rarefied book because you have to allow for, you know, all the different formats, but it can get really good. And it is frustrating how, so, you know, ebooks in the mass are still like, hello, 1999.
Yeah,
right?
Oh, yeah.
Like it's so primitive, right? That we're held back that way. And obviously, it seems like now, like, why can't we do? Technically, it should be possible right now to have, you know, if we can have kind of a lovely responsive site, why can't ebooks be like responsive sites and they work on every device and so like that?
Yeah.
Because of Amazon and the Kindle and
the,
you know,
the Kindle whiteness.
Kindle is still limiting us. Yeah. The main issue, I think, is not whether they can, but is the economics. You know, like, so one thing that when this first happened, you know, publishers were briefly like, kind of terrified. And the fact what they've discovered is the opposite, is that, you know, ebooks took the place of, like, you know, those books you get at the airport. I mean, they still do print them, but no one near as many. Like, ebooks took the place primarily in the market chain of the disposable book.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of book that there was no defense for it as printed because it was ugly anyway. Like, you can't point to those mass produced books and say, let's save them. They're beautiful, because they're not.
Yeah.
They're ugly. So if an ebook, if a cheap mass produced ebook is ugly, it's replacing a printed book that was just as ugly, right? And those, of course, were way cheaper to make.
Yeah. Right?
So, you know, you can cram those through, really, especially if you're producing a print book anyway and you've done all the editorial, the ebook is a spin-off. It takes, you know, an hour or two. It's really cheap. And that's fine for a lot of books, like, you know, do we need beautifully designed Harlequin romances? But, you know, the worry is, I think, is that publishers, they make more money on these. Like now, like 50 Shades of Grey made Random House huge. You know, they gave every single employee $5,000, even from the janitors. Everyone got $5,000 because they made so much money off that thing. Because they didn't have to put anything into it. Right?
Yeah.
And so that's that lure of easy money. It may be harder to convince them to say, let's make them look better, right? Because you could make that argument to some extent for print books. In fact, working at, you know, Canadian sort of smaller publishers, when I was at D&M, our big thing was to bat above our weight. Like, we were, you know, one of the larger independents, us and maybe an ANSI. But I mean, that's still tiny, right? And so, but we won more design awards than any Canadian publisher, way more. I mean, we had more than almost all of them combined, because that was one thing we could do.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, we don't have the money to sign the authors at Random House does, but we can make our books look really good.
Yeah.
So they don't look cheap. They don't look amateur, right?
Totally.
And there was an economic argument that it actually made the books appeal more.
Yeah.
E-books right now, there isn't that economic argument. So that's the worry, I think, what we have, is that can we get to the stage where there is an economic argument to spend like a little more. And I mean, it not even has to be a ton, but let's at least get, you know, to the level of a decent responsive website.
Totally.
At least, right. And that would, that helps. So I think I don't think the issue is not with the technology theoretically, it's sort of where because of the industrial complexities, where it is, mm-hmm. and whether, you know, publishers will want to spend that bit of extra money to do it.
There's like a piece of software for writing called iWriter.
Oh yeah, yeah, I know that.
They use one font throughout.
Comic Sans.
I don't think it's Comic Sans. It's some like fixed width font.
Typewriter-ish.
Because I think you can only write in Markdown, or like that's sort of, you can write just regular text files in it, but it sort of understands Markdown and highlights Markdown and stuff,
it's almost like just basic text wrangler-ish kind of thing.
Yeah, but they chose to reduce like options for their, like, I don't think there's a settings panel in iWriter. I don't know, which is like kind of amazing for software. Maybe there is. I could be wrong.
They're minimalist.
They're extremely minimalist. But I know you had also said during the Books on the Radio interview that, like, there's too many options for users within ebooks.
Yeah.
So if you could create the reader of all readers, like, say the three of us found a company and we a little reader startup, and obviously you're the most qualified type designer and typographer amongst the three of us, so we'd leave it to you to pick the font for the UI.
Oh god, you were gonna ask that.
What font would you pick?
Whoa, that you know,
pick Comic Sans or Rosie.
Yeah. What, that's I should have prepped that. What would I pick as the screen font? Jeez, that is it's interesting because, you know, there are faces that like softly slab faces, you know, like actually one, a kind of underestimated typeface, you know, from Adobe Chaparral is really nice on screen, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of sort of soft, sort of soft, sort of neo slab, kind of works sort of really well. I'm trying to think what else that do I tend to like. Swift, if you know that, Gerhard Unger, it's actually a newspaper typeface. It's serif typeface. It's toothier, heavier. I like that. I actually really like.
I haven't heard of that one actually.
Yeah, Swift. I think it's from the late 60s, but then he did
what's it called again?
Swift.
Swift.
Okay. And he did like a Swift Noya like a handful of years ago. Re-engineered. It's really good. It's really nice on screen. Zero, which is a sans serif face from a few years ago, if you guys know that.
Okay.
That's really, really pretty on screen.
Yeah.
And that, and it has that high kind of, you know, range of sort of widths and weights. But of course, I'm not picking one. Another one actually that's really good on screen, this would also be one of Xeris Whitman, which you probably know that type. Mm-hmm. Again, it's these ones with simple forms that, you know, that, I think one thing that really makes a difference is to pick type that reflects the technology it's made with. You know, Garamond, like a nice version of Garamond is not bad on screen or whatever. But I hate the fact that most of the typefaces, like you go in and you know you have like an e-reader. Like there's probably the best e-reader. I'll give a plug out there. Software called Marvin.
Marvin.
Okay. It's probably the best e-reader out there.
Okay.
It has some really nice controls. You can you can change like everything, like which I'm complaining about. But if you change everything, you can actually make it look really nice. Like you can control the margins because most e-readers don't have proper margins.
Yeah.
Better margins. You can rag the type. You can actually make warmer in the background. In fact, he's even got this thing where you can make it so it tints like firelight, so it's a warmer one. It's too many options.
Nice.
Control the type, but the type choices are still limited, you know, to like you end up with the Arial type things, so, you know, those sort of the defaults. Georgia. I mean, Georgia's it's a beautiful typeface.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. It's like, you know, overdone, right? Or you end
Web
up with
2.0.
Yeah. Or, it's still better than a lot of choices.
Right. It's true.
Still is. Yeah. I mean, it's Matthew Carter. It is a brilliant design. But you end up with all those ones like the Garamonds, the Caslons, those typefaces that, you know, those are printing typefaces.
Yeah. Right?
And I almost never use, unless I want something to look old. Mm-hmm. I don't ever use those typefaces. So I try and use now mostly. I mean, sometimes I'll use mid-century typefaces because I love mid-century design. Like,
yeah.
So I still use, you know, the Gothics and sort of Accidents and Futura and Trade. And, you know, I love those typefaces.
Mm-hmm.
But when I can, I try and use new typefaces because they're designed on the technology we use for the technology we use. They just make more sense, you know. Mm-hmm. Like it's kind of like you know, Bodoni looks its best printed by Bodoni.
Yeah.
Because it was designed by him for the technology at the time.
Yeah.
Right? Nobody beats Baskerville's Baskerville, and you know, because again, they were, it was all a piece. It's all together, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, there are nice digital versions of both those typefaces, and I do use them. Bodoni still I love for display. But ideally, especially for screen, you know, you want to use, I think, typefaces designed in the digital realm as much as possible.
For sure,
they just
yeah.
look better. They're yeah. designed, you know, someone's designing it on a Mac, mm-hmm. it's going to look better on a screen than something they've designed with pencil and paper mm-hmm. because, you know, it's a better match to the medium. Yeah.
Cool.
So if you ever pick one, Comic Sans.
Comic Sans. No. Has everyone read the McSweeney's I'm Comic Sans Asshole?
No.
Oh, Google that. Folks, if you haven't, I'm Comic Sans Asshole. It's a McSweeney's piece. Really funny. Really funny. But, you know, yeah. picking on Comic Sans, it's like shooting fish in a barrel.
Right? Yeah.
It's like, I would rather pick on Universe.
Yeah.
I hate that typeface.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, okay, Adrian Frutiger, yes, he was a genius.
Oh, yeah. You told me about it back in 2008.
It's a type of Hitler would use, right?
Yeah.
Because it's too perfect. It's like, yeah. and it's so, it has no soul, I think. Yeah. Like, it's got no mistakes in it. And it's so cold. It, like, you know, yeah. it's got, like, it's sexless. It's just gonna be, you know, I mean, of course.
Sexless
type. Yeah, it is, absolutely. Yeah. You know what? Look at the number 2. You want to judge a typeface? Look at the 2.
Yeah.
And, I mean, nobody would ever sleep with the 2 in Universe. Never. Yeah. It is the coldest, most unappealing 2 you'll ever see. Just look at it, right?
And it's funny because, like, behind Peter's back, like, there's a book called Sex Lies. Yeah.
Sean's been noticing that book, I guess. So. I remember somebody telling me once that Max Olson, actually, he told me once, you were looking at some of his work, and he was using Accidents Grotesque. And
I love Accidents Grotesque.
And
yeah.
I think you said it was like jazz.
Well, that was a compliment, honestly.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. When you look at Accidents compared to Helvetica or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I like Helvetica too, yeah. but I do like Accidents better, I think, overall.
It's got just more funk.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's a little funkier. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Cool. Another quote from the same interview. I've never been an unrepentant optimist about anything, even when I was 5 years old. So that seems like kind of interesting to me. Do you consider yourself a pessimist?
You know, it's funny. The older I get, I'm probably less overtly pessimistic. It's just like it's too depressing to be pessimistic when you get older. Like, it's sort of like, well, you know, now all these things that I was pessimistic about are actually real. So I don't know. I guess I'm a pessimistic optimist or an optimistic pessimist, right? Like, kind of like that. Instead of the glasses half full or the glasses half empty, it's just like, you know, hopefully there's a decent drink in it.
Yeah.
So somewhere in between. Yeah. I used to say, definitely when I was kind of younger, that, the big advantage of pessimism is you're never disappointed,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, you always imagine the worst will happen, and if anything better than that happens, hooray, right?
But, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, it's harder to sustain that level of complete grumpiness. You get, I don't know, it's boring after a while. You know? So I'm not as grumpy as I was.
That's good.
So a lot of designers feel plagued by this content, and this motivates them to move in different direction in their career, trying new things, leaving certain positions or aspects of their career behind. Do you ever feel this content?
Oh, yeah. I think that's a really good question, actually, and we could actually talk like a long thing about that. It's that it is the, you know, everyone gets into this for one way or the other because they want to do something creative, right? That and the nature of it, I think, and especially it can be shocking when you start, right? Especially, I think, if you finish a degree, and you know, if you've had a good degree, you get a chance to do a lot of creative work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you leave and you get a job, and you discover that you know, there's a lot more nuts and bolts.
It's really different,
a lot more of the grind. You know, when you get to a higher level, there's a little less, but there's always a lot of it. There's always a lot of, for every, like, every kind of bit, every idea, there's a lot more making, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I've always thought, actually, that you know, the idea is the easy part.
Yeah.
Honest with you, right? It's like it's making it. Making, right. You know, is actually the hard part. Mm-hmm. And making it work and on time and on budget and all those kinds of things. So, but that can be a grind for everybody.
Yeah.
Right? Is it, you know, that, and I've been definitely at that, like, you get to that level where some certain projects you think, like, how many times have I essentially done this?
Yeah.
Like, countless times, absolutely. And you do always want, you do always think that, yeah, I'd like to do something that's different, right? I mean, for me, I actually would like to eventually get to the stage where it is, I wanted this for like, everyone wants this probably, where it is a little more kind of hands off.
Yeah.
And, you know, you are kind of able to do the kind of the bigger projects. It's hard in Vancouver because we have so many designers. There's a lot of good designers in Vancouver, but we're really not a big market, right? Mm-hmm. We are a small, you know, you go back to Toronto or you go to, you know, big centers in the States or any of that, and there is more of this happening. I mean, I'd love to see, to find a way to bring more of these kinds of things because we have the people that do it, but to bring the projects. So, you know, I mean, God bless real estate because it's kept a lot of designers working. But after a while, how many real estate websites can you design, right? You know, how many hockey books can I design? I mean, yeah, you don't want to know how many books I design, right? After a while, there's a lot of that. So, I mean, the ideal for me is to have the kind of client where, you know, you are working on design at a much more conceptual level. So it's not where someone comes in and says, I need a brochure, right? Like, you're not, and I don't want any grain in the brochure, right? So you're not thinking of that kind of thing, where it's someone comes to you with a specific, it's a problem, whatever you want to call it, right? And you come back and say, look, okay, you don't need a website. Mm-hmm. You don't need a book, you don't need a poster. What you need to do is to set a bus on fire.
Right? Sounds like fun.
Yeah, it's a left field thing. Like I have one design regret I always have is that way back when I worked at Kent Allen, we had this great contract for like 3 days, a week, whatever it was, and then it fell apart. We were subcontracted to an architecture firm. We used to do a lot of kind of wayfinding and signage and identity projects. Mm-hmm. And this architecture firm was supposed to design this music museum in Nashville, which I think got built. But, and we were subcontracted to do all the signage.
Right? Yeah.
And essentially what happened, we were all set up. We literally were going to go to Nashville. I was on the team by this. I moved up stage. And I mean, we had airplane tickets. And then I'm still not sure what happened. The architecture firm eventually, they lost, something happened. They lost the contract.
Yeah.
So we lost the contract. But I was so excited because we were going to pitch this idea that I had presented, right? This is a music museum, that there would be no visual signage. It would all be auditory.
Oh, man.
So because it was going to be genres, right? So you'd find the blue, you'd walk in and there'd be all the sound, and to find the blues wing, you have to find and follow the blues song, and to find the country, you know, et cetera, et cetera, right? So it's a music museum. So we would use sound as the sole guiding thing. It might've been stupid. It might not have worked, but, the idea of being able to do things at that level, to say, like, let's not do it what you expect. You expect signage. No signage. You got to hear it.
Right? Totally.
And if someone said, well, what about the deaf? What do they do with music museum, right?
Totally, I mean,
that's, the reality is you're deaf. You're probably not getting a lot out of the experience, right?
Yeah. To steal a thoughtful question from another podcaster, Mike Hurley, who admittedly stole this question from James Lipton, who hosts Inside the Actors Studio.
Well, you know, amateurs borrow, professionals steal, right?
That's right. So I guess I'm like extremely professional right now in the podcasting realm.
Oh, it's okay.
How would you like to be remembered?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, okay. I don't, you know, let me give you a designer's answer, right? Is that I would like to have a really well-designed funeral. I've actually thought about this a lot, and it seems too morbid, but I once thought of it as a school project for students to say, let's design your funeral, your tombstone.
You can only use Universe for the typing.
Except, you know, you think of these things, but then you start to, you know, you get depressed. You think, my God, okay, it seems fun, but I wouldn't be there to appreciate it.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, that, it's still kind of a designer, but just like, I don't want to be cremated. right? Like, I want to go in the ground and I want a tombstone. Yeah. Like, old school, right? Ideally, what I would like is
lots of space for nice typography.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Lovely stone carving. Yeah. Lovely stone carving. And, you know, ideally, it's a nice, like, old Irish style where they carry you through the streets.
Yeah.
Right? Like, men in black hats. And they, I'm not a religious person, but I would like the 23rd Psalm, like the whole, and it has to be raining. So, you know, if I do.
Vancouver's perfect for you then.
Yeah, exactly.
Black umbrellas, yeah, hillside.
It has to be kind of gloomy outside on a hillside and all the rest of it, right? So, you know, that would be good. But that's only my, that's not my first choice. My first choice is just, I have no plans to die. So you're not going to forget me because I'm going to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Somebody said on my Twitter, or it was either on Twitter or my Facebook feed, somebody just wrote, like, this is the generation that won't die. And I was like,
there you go.
Yeah.
Who knows how that's going to happen? But
I don't know.
Yeah. That was great. Where can people find you online if to contact you and swamp you with work?
You know, okay, this is the sad, embarrassing thing. It's like I have a URL. I literally have the world's crappiest coming soon thing that was done in a Starbucks in Toronto.
Oh, man.
In like 10 minutes, I was about to go off to a meeting. And I had like cards with the URL and I thought, shit, I need to put something on there. So in theory, someday, very soon, like when I finish this swag of work, I will, you know, actually design a website.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I probably, you know, if you go to my LinkedIn page, that's got all the, you know, that at least is live and up to date, or, you know, just Google me through Emily Carr and stuff like that, they can. So it's embarrassing to be in this, it comes from years, of course, being in house, and you never wanted any more work. You always had too much to do.
Yeah.
So you didn't advertise. So now I need to, advertise, as it were. Yeah.
And you don't use social media?
You know, that I've had a lot of people say, Facebook, I just, no offense to Facebook users, but it always struck me as something for 14-year-old girls. I don't know. I think it's the name. It just seems like I can't get over that. Twitter, I can see, could be fun. Like, you know, there are definitely people I read on there who are fun. And
no Instagram, like your selfies and stuff?
No, and it's mostly just like time. Is that so? I have had people over the years say, oh, you should tweet, and I always think that. But then, of course, the pressure is you want to be funny every time.
Yeah.
Right? So there was a thing that students were doing that Chip, my type teacher, said.
Yeah, I was going to say, because
it was the students the last
you.
Couple of years. Yeah. And, and it was sweet to hear that. Almost always they got the quote not quite right.
Yeah.
But, still, it was. I don't know if anyone's going to keep that up now that the people who did it have all graduated.
Yeah.
That I should, of course, do it myself. But I'm just like what would I say? Like, I work really hard and then I get lazy. So as soon as I'm finished what I have to do, it's like, no. And so,
it's time consuming, right?
Yeah. So I'm
fully understand.
What I do is I kind of closet tweet. Like, in other words, there are people who I will send something to who, you know, they'll say, that's great. I'll put it up there. And like, I'm too lazy to actually run the feed myself. But yeah.
Okay.
So that's, you know, there I am. I know I'm kind of an antediluvian crank that way. Yeah, you can look that up.
Nice. So that's our show. Thanks for being on.
Is there theme music at all?
There is. We close out to Gangstar's Full Clip.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty good. Yeah.
Just the instrumental.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And we haven't purchased the rights, and that's why we don't have sponsors.
Right. So, right. Yeah.
I think Bill Cunningham, like the new photographer for the New York Times, I guess, and Details or whatever from
he's
back.
He's like really, really, I mean, he's in his 80s.
Yeah. I just watched Bill Cunningham New York for the second time last night, but he said the key is to not get paid for your work because then you can do whatever you want.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I don't know. But,
I think you should get Sean to like hum the theme.
Let's try it.
Sure. What do you guys want to listen to? Miley Cyrus? Justin Bieber? Bring it.
But as all our listeners know, you can find us at making_combo on Twitter. And also you can check out all this episode and all of our past episodes at makingconversation.ca. And if you have any feedback for us or that we can relay to Peter, you can email at feedback@makingconversation.ca. This show will be up on SoundCloud as well and on iTunes. And we thank you very much for listening again.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Thank you, Peter.